He does a really good more than work.
Feeney, you've heard it at least 10 times at this point. You're probably sick of it, like.
The Hard Yards. Passionate about sport.
It's gone to the short side. Oh, it's not gone to the short side. It's gone to the try line. Colin Murray.
I don't think we met before, but I'm the referee on this field, not you.
Hi, Rob. Zeeb's here. Just want to discuss the captaincy next.
He's calling.
And Ringrose comes through. Oh. That is brilliant from Ringrose. Ringrose is going here. What a score.
This is The Hard Yards. I'm Andy McGeady. We have a really good show lined up for you today. I have Kevin McLaughlin and Pat McCarry and IRFU performance analyst Vinnie Hammond. And we also have a big interview with Connacht second row Alton Delan later in the show. Gents, hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Andrew, how are you?
Mr. Hammond, how are you?
Are you well?
Very well.
Yeah. We'll come back to how early you were up this morning, right? But we have a different starting point today. Pat, what are you doing at the start of December?
What am I doing at the start of December?
Yeah.
Are
you putting on a big red suit?
I was like, we have a baby due, so I was like, is it due that soon? Like, yeah, I'm going to retake to the stage. It's been 4 years since I've done some acting, so I'm going back to... this is actually a good plug. They'll be delighted with me. The Ballally Players were doing some Christmas show in Marley House, and at the moment I've been cast as Santa Claus, so that's why the beard is.
You got to work on the pot belly now.
This is going to be character acting. There's going to be stuff in my face over the next month.
Yeah, you've done some stuff on stage and performance, have you, Kev?
Absolutely not.
No.
Next.
You sure? You sure?
True. Actually, if you could ask him to sing, Andy, because he used to sing for UCD under 20s. He used to sing at a piano.
Yeah, yeah, I'll sing us out. I'll sing us out at the podcast. No problem. No,
for the Christmas special, right? Chalk it down. I'll come back to that.
We're looking for a bit of music.
He does a really good more than work.
Feeney, you've heard it at least 10 times at this point. You're probably sick of it. Like,
yeah. Our audience hasn't. We'll make sure these are rolling from the start around Christmas.
I'm just putting Sting idea down here. For yeah. Other words.
All right. Listen, we'll move past Christmas stuff. Mr. Zeebo, a nice little present. I'm not sure how nice it is for Munster fans, but there's a big opportunity there for a young man with a young family to go to France. Pat, I think, how we say, the informed speculation is that Racing seem to be the team. They haven't actually confirmed it yet, though, have they?
No, so it has been confirmed, all signs are pointing to it, and it's going to be, I think the talk was that Pau might have been in there and Toulouse as well, but then once Racing got the sniff that he was serious about making the move, and this wasn't just one of these smokescreen things to get a better IRFU deal, that they gave him a shout, and I suppose there's those Munster connections over in Paris now as well, so he'll pitch up well there, and he'll do well, like, fluent in French. He might have to brush up on it as well, but has that X factor about him, and he'll do really well over there. You know, we would have liked to have kept him around till after the World Cup, but he would have been 29. But if he wants to go now, yeah.
Kev, is that the big surprise here? That just it's he's gone maybe a year and a half earlier than people thought he might go.
Yeah, it's it's his decision.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think he made the call and he realizes the risks that are involved. I think if you look at some of the guys that have gone abroad, it's very, very clear. The IRFU have made a statement that they will now automatically prefer players that are on Irish soil and playing here. So I think he's got all the data to make that decision, and that's what he's gone with. I think, like, he's a phenomenal loss for Munster in particular. I think
off field is quite a big loss, actually, in terms of their marketing side.
Yeah, like, he's their biggest, like, he's one of the biggest brand pulls in Ireland, in Irish rugby, not just Munster rugby. But, like, the slightly concerning thing for Munster is you've got Pau, okay, and you've got guys like Dave Foley, Sean Dougal,
Paddy Butler as well.
James Colum was down there as well.
He's
retired.
There's almost like a little bit of a Munster community there. And now in Racing, you've got Rog and Dunners, and now potentially, like you're saying, Zeebo going down there. Like, you don't want to make it too comfortable for guys to move.
What, do you want to send over a sleeper just to break up the comfort zone?
But, like, that definitely helps your decision. If you're going over, like, say when Dave Foley's making up his mind, he's like, two Munster lads on the phone to him saying, man, the weather over here is class. We drink a glass of wine every night.
Yeah.
The training isn't too bad. We play big games every weekend. Like, that completely alters your psychology. The same way as Zeebo was definitely on the phone to Dunners going, what's it like over there? Well, I like it. So you don't, from a Munster point of view, that's slightly concerning. Like, you're looking at six players over the course of 3 or 4 years moving over the, over to France. So there's no other province really in a position like that. You've got a couple of guys leaving from the other provinces, but not many at all.
No, I suppose we'll probably jump from there straight into the Champions Cup because, you know, there was the Munster Racing game. Vinny, were you like everyone else, sort of after about an hour of that, were you wondering if you'd ever clocked a nil-all draw in a top-tier game?
Yeah, well, the problem for us is that we would look at the defence and the attack separately. In that game, I was actually doing the defence. So, yeah.
Short straw.
It was a short straw that weekend, but it was a phenomenal game to be nil-all because I think games like that, you're looking at, you probably switch on the scoreboard and you go, oh, no way, but it was so... it was just so physical for so long and neither side were going to break and eventually Munster just held out that little bit longer. And I think when you look at a big player like Conor Murray in a big game and Johnny Sexton does the same in the really big games, they seem to be the momentum shifters. And in that one, it was Conor, you know, and that changed the whole tone of the game. So
we've got, I think we'll do a state of the provinces here. So after two rounds in, it's in general not too bad. Munster, while we stay on the subject, second in that pool, but it's a very, very tight pool.
Yeah, and then the doubleheader against Leicester coming up, aren't they? Like, so that's exactly what they needed to do, but everybody is still almost in the mix in that group. Like, no one's out of it yet, so they'll kind of be delighted with that again, because they would have been questioned again at the start of the season, is can Munster do it, another season of upheaval? So they gave another solid answer there at the weekend.
They're in good shape though. I think, like, they get 5 points in the Christmas fixtures. They're right in the mix. I think they'll probably pick up a bonus point win at home to Cast don't travel well. So yeah, like, they're right in the mix. They're in good shape. I think they would have absolutely bitten your hands off for a 6 point start, you know.
Ulster mixed got properly trounced by La Rochelle. That second half was something else.
Yeah, like, John O'Gibbs would have been absolutely disgusted with that second half performance. They got beaten up. Like, there was no other way to describe it. Because the first half was good. I thought they played good rugby. I thought they were right in the mix. They, like, quietened down the crowd a little bit.
Kept the TV audience interested as well.
Yeah. And then just from the start of the second half, La Rochelle came out of the traps. And, like, you know, in the halftime in the change room, you're thinking that. You're away in France. You're going, guys, the first 10 minutes here are going to be tough. Like, we need to dig in. They're going to come flying at us. They didn't play that well in the first half. And I was just very disappointed with how they responded. I know the coaches in Ulster would have been disappointed as well. Felt like maybe a little bit of a lack of leadership. Perhaps they should have brought Bestie on at halftime just got him in there.
Really?
Yeah, potentially. Like, I just feel like that first 10 minutes, like, was so key. They needed to be in the game at 50, 55. And then, they're in great shape to pick up a point. But going away there from there with nothing now has put them in a really, really tricky position.
Yeah, they ship points at a rate of knots at one point in that second half.
Yeah, and La Rochelle are very good. You give them a sniff and they'll punish you. Mm. And I think, like, we're not going to go down this path, but, like, they're missing an out-and-out 10. Like, Leila Fan has a great 12. He's played most of his rugby at 12. Like.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Cooney's an awesome 9, and he's kind of finishing the game at 10. And he did fine, but, like...
And he did that for Connacht at the end of last season when they had injury problems as well. But we would agree, he's a 9 rather than a...
He's a phenomenal athlete and footballer, so he can play 10. But, like, he's most comfortable at 9. Ulster most comfortable when he's at 9. So, like...
Yeah, but obviously they've got well-documented problems with player availability at that position. But then going to Leinster... 10 points, and that was a decent haul from the Glasgow game, Pat.
That was brilliant. Because I would have tipped against them last week. I would have thought Glasgow had everything to lose, so they would have got a result against them. But Leinster, absolutely brilliant. The pack was great. Keane Healy back in good form. Sexton made a big call just before half time when they won a penalty off a scrum. Not only just to, I think they could have taken, first of all, to go for the scrum and then to go for the attacking line out and then to get them all over and get a try. Like, so just two or three big calls as a captain, which he actually would have loved, and the pack would have, back in the pack as well. And then they were just great in the second half and really closed it out. And again, we talked about that. Vinny talked about that. Sexton and Murray, these guys who just keep producing when they have to in the big games as well.
Yeah. So not forgetting Connacht, top of Pool 5 in the Challenge Cup with a visit from a friend of the podcast, Donegal O'Callaghan, to the sports ground. But what's the state of play? Leinster are 4-1 second favourites behind Saracens, Munster are 14-1 and Ulster are 35-1. That's the win the tournament outright. Now, Mr. Hammond, you are a high-performance analyst for the IRFU. What does a high-performance analyst do?
I suppose it's a mix of all sorts. At the moment, the obvious thing is we're prepping for the November series, the Guinness series, which is that takes up the kind of guts of the 4 or 5 weeks leading into it for us in terms of prepping for opposition players, opposition plays. And outside of that, really, we're constantly just monitoring our own players, right the way from under-18s, 19s, 20s, 7s, women's 7s and women's 15s. So any of those teams that fall under the high-performance bracket, there's somebody tracking and coding and analysing all the players that are involved in that. So, and doing the same then for our counterparts around the world, so we know roughly where we stand, not just against ourselves, but against what's considered to be the kind of world's best or best practice or best standard, whatever you want to call it.
So how do you become an analyst?
Well, for me, it was actually an injury in UCD when I was playing there. So I did my wrist and then I couldn't play. I actually wasn't that good anyway, so that didn't help. But so I got injured and then I just took up the director of rugby there, John McLean, had a very early iteration of an analysis system, but then he bought another system that he clearly couldn't work. And I was kind of sitting in the office, like he said, "Oh, will you try and do this?" So I did that while I was still studying in UCD, and then went and did a master's in Cardiff in performance analysis. And most of the people I studied with there are kind of gone on to do, say, work in British cycling or tennis, whatever it might be. And there was only a few of us really specializing in rugby at the time, and came back and did some work here, and lucky enough, been the IRFU now for 10 years. So
I want to bring in Kevin in here a second, but I want to come back to something I mentioned earlier on. What time are you up this morning?
We usually start early, but I've been getting a bit of stick for giving out about in an interview about how early we have to get up for the line, so I can't give out about getting up early anymore. I think I've beaten that drum hard enough.
So you're not giving out, you're just stating a fact. What time did your first email arrive in this morning?
The first emails, they usually start around 5:45. Around 5:45.
Yeah, so this is where we bring Kev in. Kev, Joe Schmidt doesn't sleep.
He doesn't sleep much, I don't think. I'm just going to go back to something Vinny said. He wasn't a great player. Myself and Vinny actually played together, UCD under-20s and for the UCD senior team, and he's a great player. And I think the fact that he actually played at a high level gives him the ability to do what he does today, as he understands the game. I think having played it just gives you a huge advantage. But going back to Joe, I think he has a phenomenal work ethic, and he demands a phenomenal work ethic from all around him, not just the players, but from all the staff as well. And I think Vinny will attest to that.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think that's fine. I think he leads by example, Vinny. Like, he never switches off, really, does he? Like, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, the big drivers of any culture, I suppose, should be the guy at the top, the person at the top. And if you kind of see them living as they kind of want everyone else to live, it definitely does have an impact on the group. And that goes right the way for all the other staff as well, not just Joe. You know, you look at the backroom team he's kind of assembled around him with Richie Murphy, Greg Feek, Andy Farrell and Simon Easterby, and that's a pretty good coaching setup now, that they all work ridiculously hard to get very, very small margins achieved in very, very short time frame. And I think when you're involved in the national team as well, you do only have real pockets with the players, so they do a massive amount of going around and actually into provinces, into the kind of day-to-day environment of a player, and trying to get, you know, guys one-on-one as much as they can, and talk to guys outside of camp. Because when we're in camp, really, if you think about the week of an international, if you work backwards, you might play on a Saturday. Team run is on a Friday, so you don't really do too much in the team run, especially if you're away from home. You can do a session on a Thursday, a down day on Wednesday, and if it's a Monday session or a Tuesday, you're potentially still recovering from the week before. So a lot of the time, these guys only really have the guts of two sessions to prepare for a test match.
So what are you doing in that time, right? So let's say you're in camp and we've had the first test match, the first test match of the autumn series. You're doing stuff during the game for Joe, and you're in the coach's box there. So give us a high level. What are you doing there in that environment?
Yeah, I think there's lots of misconceptions about what we actually do, because some people think, oh yeah, you're the guy who sits there in the coach's box, and he's like, what do you actually have in front of you? A lot of the time, what we're trying to do is just confirm or read into what we didn't perhaps think that was going to happen, you know. So we're like looking to see, well, what we worked on during the week, is it happening in front of us? And very often we're just answering questions that, you know, okay, can we go back and check where the setup for the last scrum, or can we go back and look at the walk-in from the last line out? And it's tiny, tiny margins that you're trying to figure out and trying to find in the mid-game, because there is no, I think I said this recently, if you look at the 2014, 2015 Six Nations win, they're so marginal, you know, you come down to points difference, tries scored, tries conceded. And if it's a case where you can get a 3 or 6 point score, and again, you think back to Jamie Heaslip's tackle on Hogg in the Scotland game, you know, that's the difference between us winning and losing the championship. And that might be a very, very small moment in the context of the game, but that's everything in the context of the competition, you know.
So then once the game ends, then you guys have a long night. So talk us through what you're doing then for Joe and for the players.
Yeah, well, I would pay anything for all the games to kick off at 1 p.m. 1 p.m. would be perfect, because then we'd have an evening. But you think of a kickoff, especially during the summer, 19:45 kickoff, you start your work at 12:30. But realistically, we do have quite a good system. So myself, Mervyn Murphy, and there's Jeff Blackburn in there as well with us. So we've three of us constantly working on the game from the moment that the final whistle goes. And you just get into kind of autopilot for the first few hours, and you know the same things are going to be asked every week. So we do have some consistency, and that's really important, I think, with feeding back to players as well, because you can't go judging them on one set of criteria 1 week and then the next week say you did this, but you're judging them against something else. And I think Kev probably agreed that if you're a player, all you want to be doing to be judged by is the same yardstick as the week before and as everybody else, you know.
So when you say that you get into autopilot, is that like coding the game by hand and then splitting up into various, you know, KPIs, seeing how players did?
Exactly, yeah. And I think we probably come up with, we work kind of coach by coach. So I worked a lot with Andy on the defence in the last, since he's come in. So I know, roughly speaking, it takes a little bit of time to tune into what a coach is looking for. I think that's where the kind of knowledge of the knowledge of the sport is important. You know, we would have had Les Kiss there for a long time, and it would probably take the guts of maybe 6 months to get really in tune with what he sees, to make sure what he sees is the same as what I see or what Merv sees. So when he sees a soak tackle, for example, we need to know what a soak tackle looks like in his eyes and not our eyes. So you kind of, it's like tuning up to another coach and trying to align your thoughts with what he's thinking and not necessarily what you think. And I know that's kind of, you know, that's kind of tricky, but at the same time, they're the guys who are at the front, they're the guys who are coaching, so you have to go with what they think and kind of implant their brain as much as they can into yours, you know?
Yeah, that's so, like, just getting in there, Vinny, like, it's so interesting and it's so important, because, say, Joe, Andy, like, the coaches there will, in meetings, I know from reviews, be incredibly consistent in the messages they're delivering. And the words you used there in terms of your analysis, consistency, is incredibly important too. Because if the way you're classifying things is not a direct reflection of the way they're talking about things in previews and reviews, then we have a big problem. Alignment between you and the coaches is phenomenally important. And players, after a game, particularly after a hard game, you're tired, you're a bit emotional, if you've lost, whatever's going on, you're looking at your stats, and I'm sure you've seen it, Vinny, like, lads can get pretty obsessed and pretty upset if they feel like something, if they've been hard done by. And I do remember certain players.
What do you mean by hard done by?
So sitting and looking at their stats and going, Vinny, that's fucking bullshit, that's not a soak, or whatever, you know? And I'm sure Vinny's heard loads of that. I remember Leinster, it used to happen all the time. There were certain guys that would pull our analyst in there, sit him down, and go through every single stat every single week and question every single one, which is too much of an obsession. Like, I think, like, you're putting maybe too much weight in stats there. But, like, Vinny, I'm sure you've had some experience of that as well. But it is so important that you're aligned with the coaches. So no Vinny, doubt about it.
Vinny, have you ever been brought into a dark room by an angry player?
Yeah.
It's always the same guys. It's always the same guys. They look over and they usually go, "What? What's this?" And you say, "Oh, well, you know, this like a it's a soak tackle." And then they pull up someone else's clips and go, "How come he didn't get a soak tackle?" That's the worst one, because that means they've actually gone to the bother looking at all the other soak tackles to make sure that their one is aligned with the other ones. But no, most of the time, look, players get into a routine and they know, give or take, like the natural human eye or the human judgment of everything, that we do try to be pretty consistent with how we code and how we break down players' performance. But yeah, look, there's always a good bit of crack too, because if it is the same guys coming at you the whole time, like Paul O'Connell is a nightmare. Mm. So, but in a great way, you know, and that pushes you to make sure that anything.
Vinny covers himself with that comment, yeah, right.
But like the whole
lovely guy.
the whole post match analysis thing is like, for me, there was like a life cycle. It was after a game, you're so tired and exhausted. You're pretty satisfied generally if you've won or whatever. The next day you get up and you're like, Jesus, actually, did I actually play well? You go in, you start looking at your stats. You're like, oh, fuck. All you see is your mistakes. Hmm. Then the Monday you start to go through it with the coaches and with the likes of Vinny and stuff. You talk through your mistakes. You feel a little bit better about them. For me, it was only by sort of Tuesday where you can actually start putting that game behind you and move on. So the way the whole thing is presented to the players is very important. I think it has to be. The stats are important, but actually there are more important things and stats are big moments in games that make a difference.
It's
like the Jamie Heaslip moment. He could have dropped the ball 5 times, his stats would have been poor, but he still had the biggest moment in the entire Six Nations, and Joe knows that, and for that reason Joe's going to keep him on the field. And like Joe and experienced coaches can see the bigger picture. I remember playing against Scarlets on Hine Cup, I think it was 2011-2012 season, away, and I was absolutely devastated on the Sunday because I came in and I'd hit like 5 rucks, made 3 tackles and made 1 carry or something like that. And I went to Joe and I went to Bumper, our analyst, Emmett Farrell. I was like, what's wrong? Like, I don't know what went wrong. I felt tired after the game. And they're like, that's fine. Sometimes the game just gets away from you. Don't worry about the stats. Like, just get prepared for next weekend. And like, that was huge for me. And if Joe had said, your stats were a disgrace, we're dropping you, like, that would have really, really scarred me, and it would have made me stats obsessed. So,
yeah.
So talk.
I think we're good in that regard. I think most top level coaches are. They see the difference between a statistic and a performance, you know, and that's really important for me too. There's so many variables involved in any single game that to give a guy a cold number at the end and say this is number of X or this is whatever it might be, that is just a counterintuitive way of doing it, and I really can't see the benefits in it long term, because I think, like you said, players just want to know, you know, can they perform in the really big moment in the game? That's far superior than to maybe dropping 2 passes along the way, you know?
But it's interesting, we talk about the stats, but Vinny, what you're talking about is the stats which you guys have actually put together based on your understanding of what your coaches, of how they see the game, which I think is a really important point. But there's also entire industries there which, you know, media, post-game, you're given a sheet, here's the immediate stats, same word. You know, these are not the same thing.
Yeah, that's it. Just saying that, like, you were talking about Emma Farrell there. Like, I've spoken to him in the past about the likes of like a Jamie Heaslip or a Peter O'Mahony. They might not have great stats at the end of the game, but yet they're probably doing exactly the job that they've been asked to do. Like, and
but mainly their stats will not be the same as the ones that will be seen internally. Mm. Vinny, is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much, Andy. There's no, like, I mean, we wouldn't buy any data or present any data that we've got from third-party providers pretty much in terms of performance statistics like that, like game statistics. So, you know, those, even in like, between providers, there's a huge difference. And even post-match, I remember, you'll probably remember it better than me, but there was a Wales game a while ago where there was a 35 tackle count for someone, Dan Lydiot maybe, and all of a sudden that revised down to 27. You know, there's a human at the end of this. Nobody has done this well enough to sit down and predict all these stats by some kind of algorithm. In the NBA is the only place that I know that they can actually code a game completely start to finish with metrics in it that are actually relevant with accuracy. Whereas in rugby, there's no system that can code up a match, tell you who's made the tackle, who's made the carry, and for how long.
No, and just because I know Kev wants to come in here, but to expand on Vinny's point, there's a major issue with the differences in data are caused by a number of things. Firstly, you get someone like Opton, it's mainly on the ball data, it's event data or tackle data, right? And then when you go into other sports, you're looking at optical data, tracking data, trying to do that automatically. That's really, really hard in rugby because of a concept called occlusion where players come together.
Yeah.
It's really hard for the human eye can separate them. It's really hard for a computer to do so. So when they solve that problem, it would be amazing for everybody. It might even give people like Vinny a starting point, a bit of a head start in the game. But we're not there yet.
No, we're not. But you'll laugh at this one, just speaking on this topic. I remember doing a Monday review with John O'Gibbs after a Highland Cup game. And
I thought he was coming in with a sales pitch there, by the way. Sorry.
No, that's coming in a couple of minutes, don't worry.
You got your plug a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I did, and it's coming again soon. I know, Joe. So, Jono sat us down, and we went through. We'd had a terrible weekend as far as he was concerned from a line-out stat. I think we had 10 line-outs, and he was like, as far as I'm concerned, we won 8 of them, you know. And what he would consider winning a line-out is clean catch, clean delivery, and like Vinny went all about this, being able to play off it. Like,
Rog actually made that very point a few weeks back, saying you can technically win your line-out, but it's not a good win.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm getting to. And then I remember reading in the morning papers after that review that Leinster had 100% in their line-outs. So I just had a good chuckle at that. And that is a real... It's a good example of the difference in stats and how they're defined internally versus externally.
Vinny, in terms of, so that's looking at some of your work, let's say, with the national side, but you also mentioned earlier on that you were looking at the Munster match and the defence and that. What are you doing with the provinces, and do you also track the players that are playing outside the provinces?
Yeah, I think everybody that's in our kind of wider radar group is pretty much tracked to the same level, and that just means we've got consistency of judgment across any player that we want to compare pretty much in the world that's Irish qualified. So that's a massive undertaking, but it's also something that's obviously quite fruitful, because when we know what our own players are capable of, then it just makes those decisions easier. And again, we're not driven by data, we're not driven by any kind of number, especially around selection. But like, the way I see it is probably it's more like just another assistant coach sitting in the corner. The numbers that we have, and they sometimes chirp in, the numbers do, and then they chirp back out again. And where they're required, yeah, they can have some kind of an influence. But there's a human factor in the coach's eye that would always supersede the data for the moment in rugby, definitely. I just, the more I think about this, Andy, like, the people always go back to talk about baseball and Moneyball and all. And for me, that's so worn out, that argument, you know, why can't we do this in rugby? Like, baseball is the perfect storm for analytics. I know you like baseball. It literally is the perfect storm. There's a thrower, there's a batter, and there's not much else, you know? Whereas rugby, you have 15 moving parts on one side, you have 15 moving parts on the other. You've a referee who's definitely a moving part in terms of, like, the application of the laws. So you could go and do one thing one week and get away with do the following week, and it might be interpreted differently. So to be driven by a number that can be derived from that amount of mayhem and chaos is very, very difficult.
Right, so essentially what I'm hearing is stats are good, but you have to know what the stat is, you have to know what the context is in your coaching setup, and they're one voice in the room. They're not the guiding light. Fair?
Exactly. Absolutely. They're one. If they got to 1/7 of the influence of a coach's meeting, they'd be good. And, you know, like, I think Bill Belichick said something like around, like, he didn't want the stats guys giving him a 60-40. You know, like, if it comes to him and gives him an 80-20, then he'll have a look at it. And then he also followed that up by saying, well, if he's good enough coach, he'll spot the 80-20 anyway.
Vinny, is there anything like in terms of like set plays or spotting something from the opposition that you'd be kind of proud of that would kind of stand out in your Irish time? I remember speaking to Emma Farrell before, and he was talking about how he spotted some flaw in the Biarritz line out and Leinster got a try from it. Is there anything to you that would stand out over your time with Ireland?
No, I'd like to claim responsibility for both the Six Nations wins I've been involved in, but no, realistically, no.
There's your headline.
The coaches do an unbelievable job, and like we provide them with what they need to see. And like, if you think of the guys we have in that room, and the amount of experience that they have, we're just another voice in that room. And I think anything that we achieve through good coaching and really good players, you know, we can be part of it and we can enjoy it at the end. But realistically, now this I would be very reluctant to put my hand up and say, oh, I spotted this. And I can tell you all the times, like, I mean, working with an under-18s team, and I remember we played against Tolofua, the French hooker, and we had a plan to kick a ball off to him and make an example of him early, like, you know, because he was their wrecking ball. And we said, right, okay, you know, get the ball up in the air, first kick off, and we make an example of this guy. So the first kickoff goes up, you know what's going to happen. Catches the ball, 1, 2, 3 handoffs, and he's about maybe 5 yards short of our 22. Turn on. So, you mean, you do make, like, there's things where you look back on and you go, oh my God. But that was an under-18s tournament, and we actually won the tournament that year, so that was good. But no, that was a complete fuck up.
Right, it's always good to end on a fuck up. Vinny, thank you very much for your time. We will let you go.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks, yeah, thanks, Pat.
Cheers,
Stephen.
Kev will be back later to answer your Twitter questions, but up next we talk to Connacht and Ireland second row Ulta Lallan.
The Hard Yards, passionate about sport.
You're very welcome back to the Hard Yards. Pat, we've the Interpros coming up this weekend, and you were on the road this week.
Yeah, I was down in off to Galway actually this Friday for Connacht Munster. So I got down on Tuesday, and I was speaking to David Howard, their head of athletic performance, and had a big chat with Ulton Dolan down there. What was it, as the academy lads trained in the background? So yeah, he's looking forward to a lad who kind of came over to Ireland when he was only a kid and set up in Tralee. Good memories playing for Tralee Rugby Club, and now he's playing against his home province, I suppose you should say, this weekend. So yeah, really good to catch up with him. I found him in really good form as well.
And you were asking him sort of an easy question, it sounds like. How did he end up in Connacht?
Yeah, just I kicked it off by just asking him, yeah, how are you here? How are you in Galway today?
Yeah, it's an interesting start to this one.
Yeah, no, I was born in Paris, and just lived there till I was 7, really. Went to school just around the corner from the apartment, where the block where we lived. But yeah, around the age of 6, 7, unfortunately, we had a passing in our family, and my mom just felt she wanted to be closer to home, and so that brought me and my brother and her back to Kerry. We settled in Tralee, and I suppose we were near all the cousins and everything, and I suppose I dabbled in a few other sports before rugby, but it wasn't until the age of about 12 that I had a crack at rugby, and loved it from the very first training session now. And yeah, I suppose I never look back.
And did you always have the height? Did you take a growth spurt at any stage, or were you always kind of?
Yeah, I was always a little bit taller than the rest of my class, or whatever it was. And yeah, I guess I had a bit of a natural strength in me for rugby, because I definitely didn't have any technique or skill when I first tried it, but I just loved the physicality of it, and I guess it was my little advantage, even though I didn't have much talent for the sport then. But that's what made me enjoy it. So.
And you kind of said, like, it was great to catch up with your cousins and all again, and all the kind of other extended family. Did you know many of them before you came back here to Ireland?
Yeah, no, we would have gone to Ireland to Kerry on holidays every year or 2 years. I'm not too sure what it was, but I just remember that I couldn't understand anyone. My brother and I only spoke French back then, and even when my mom would speak English to us, we'd only understand an odd word here or there. But yeah, we seemed to pick up English pretty quickly when we moved over. It only took about a year or two before we were fluent. It was good to. But it was great to see the Irish family, and we as well as we had a. I had my cousin, who I suppose nearly a twin cousin of mine. We were born the same day in Paris, and he had pretty much been the best friend of mine in Paris, and he's now moved to Kerry himself now. So it's good to be near family like that.
And how did it all kind of work? Like, it wasn't exactly the kind of normal route a lot of guys would have through the school's route into rugby. How did it all kind of work out that
How did you end up here in Galway? I suppose from Tralee playing rugby, and how did you get spotted?
I started my rugby out with Tralee RFC, and I would have been involved with them from since I was, I say, 12 to 18. I was playing with I first got trials for Westminster under 16s, I think. It could have been 16s. Yeah, I was lucky enough to be selected for that. It was only 16 of us got picked for that back then. And then we trained with Westminster for I think during the year or whatever it was. And then over summer, got selected for another thing called the NTS. I think it was a trial thing they were doing. It was just they called it the National Talent Squad. It was a weird thing, but it was cool. There was a lot of players from. They had about over 40, 50 players, I think, in that. And but they said if you were good enough to get selected for that, then you stood a good chance of getting selected for Munster Youth the following season. And lucky enough, I played all right and got selected for Munster Youth. And then we almost won that Interpro. Actually, we drew at Leinster, and I think it was bet the other two provinces. And then that was that was a good year for us. And then from that, got selected for Irish Youths. And we had the first win away against, I think it was France 19s or something like that, in Brittany, which was brilliant. And then onto that played, got Munster 19s and Irish 19s. And then, but the coaches from, say, Irish Youths and Irish 19s were the Connacht Academy coaches over here. And I had a good relationship with the two of them. And I don't know, I suppose they offered me an academy contract here when Munster kind of got into the business of just saying, giving out the sub academy deals, and I obviously would have liked to have stayed, but I wanted to help out at home a bit more, so I just went with it. I went with the academy contract, and I think it was one of the best decisions I've ever made. Yeah,
I know. What was it when you kind of first broke in that big season you had with Connacht, and you first broke into the Irish setup? A friend of mine lives down in Tralee, remembers you working as a lounge boy, one of the largest lounge boys in a bar in the city centre. What is it? Did you work there for long, or do you remember much of it?
Bailey's Corner in Tralee, yeah. No, yeah, that was. I love working there. Sorry, I was a glass picker there, and the odd time might have been on the door help, just passing time maybe. But yeah, no, we had great memories down there. I knew the. My boss down there was also my scout troop leader of mine years ago when I was in the scouts, so he'd known us for years like that. But they love supporting Connacht now as well. They'll be touring this weekend now, supporting both. But I had great memories working down there.
It's an interesting one, I suppose. Yeah, the game coming up this weekend, Munster again. Is it an odd feeling every time that game comes around? Do you get kind of family and friends will be coming up to the game as well? And
yeah, It's I wouldn't say odd feeling, it's exciting because I know everyone's kind of a bit torn. Well, my family, they'd be more Connacht, supporting more of Connacht than Munster. But at the same time, they'll still like to see both teams do well. So it's always a good game. I haven't played Munster either, and I think I didn't play them at all last season. And not sure whether I'll play this weekend or not. But if I did, it'd be really exciting anyway.
We all know it's kind of the rapid rise you had, and you were kind of spotted and brought into the Irish setup pretty early. But even you must have been kind of taking it on your stride. It happened so quick. But how strange did it feel then to be in the middle of Soldier Fields, having beaten the All Blacks, and just that kind of sensation of, is this actually happening to me as well?
Yeah, no, that was it was a bit surreal. There's a few surreal moments, I suppose, over the last couple of years, but that was a really cool one. Yeah, it was a weird build up to the game. Everyone was naturally nervous, but it just everyone the squad played so well that day, and I was so lucky to even get on the field. I think, it's still hard to believe, but it was definitely one of the best memories I've ever had on a rugby field.
Because I know you spoke to, you said Paul O'Connell was probably your hero growing up, your idol as a player. To see then the pictures that he was in the crowd, Doug Howlett, and cheering you guys on kind of adds to it as well.
It was class, yeah. It was so cool. So cool. Great stadium as well.
And the with O'Connell as well, was he the main guy when you were growing up? Like, was it always a lock that you wanted to be, and was it from seeing
there
him?
There was a few of them. It was O'Connell, David Wallace, and I suppose Stanley O'Callaghan, who was playing here last weekend. Yeah, there three of them would have been. I remember being 13, 14, just thinking it would be a dream to be a bit like them, yeah, so, yeah.
And did you get to catch up with Dunnacle Callan at the end of that game last week?
I didn't, not much, no. We had other activities to do, I think, straight after the game, so it was kind of tough to catch up with players, but I know it was good to, I suppose, see them on the pitch in the sports grounds.
There was a game I was at, the UK, you were playing, I think you might have started the game against Italy in the Six Nations, it was the game to Aviva Stadium, and I remember it was one of the carries you made. It was just this insane, straight into two big Italian guys and just kind of off your feet on the carry, straight into them, took them over the gain line by a couple of yards. And as good as it was, I was thinking, geez, this guy can't do this forever. Maybe it's because he's young and hasn't had the knocks before. But have you kind of found, like, were you kind of fearless enough at the start? Have you kind of almost even learned as you went along to go along that you can't maybe fling your body around as much as you thought you could?
No, on the carrying front, I love that. I suppose I love on both sides of the ball. But I think you're more susceptible to injury doing it in the tackle. I've found recently, especially with my shoulder history. I don't know. I'm trying to. I obviously want to be as physical in defence as in attack. But I think it's nearly safer to make your tackles maybe sometimes and then try to constantly smash someone. But yeah, it's always improving. I think I can get back to the way I think I used to tackle with a bit more physicality a season or two ago, and I want that back. But I don't want to risk my risk getting a few injuries in the way. So I suppose it's just being careful with that.
And have you changed much physically in the last couple of years? Have you felt you had to kind of put on a bit more like timber to yourself, more muscle mass, anything like that?
I think I would have all right, but it's not something you really notice. Maybe you might notice it when you're carrying the ball or making a good hit sometimes, but you don't really. I wouldn't be the one to notice something like that.
The it's kind of a remarkable journey, kind of to take, and you were kind of there at a great time. Like, let's say John Muldoon would have been there since 2003, yeah. Went through some tough times as well, but you came in at a good time, didn't you, as well? Like, but
yeah.
I suppose looking back to that season, what was that kind of season like with you guys kind of on such a run and this kind of belief that was within the squad as well? It must have been strange to kind of just step straight into that.
Yeah, a lot of us from that season remember so well how it wasn't this straightforward run of just winning games. It was there was times in that season where we lost four in a row and something like that, and it didn't feel like we were going to do as well as we did, but it just shows that everyone has, you're not just because you might end up where you do, it doesn't mean it's going to be constantly up an uphill climb. It was up and down for us quite a lot that season, and we came out of it pretty well, I suppose, but yeah, it wasn't as straightforward as everyone thought. I think we definitely took some. I mean, even before the quarters or the semi-final, we played Treviso away and lost that one. For us that didn't play, we were thinking, oh geez, we've just blown it now. And I mean, that was so close to the end of the season as well, and like it still came out good for us. So.
The we would have spoken, I think, last week to Dennis Leamy, and he was a guy. More so like he was a guy who did his talking on the pitch, didn't talk out much in the dressing room, but every now and then he said he felt compelled, like he said maybe it was just pure anger, he might just speak up in the dressing room. But what are you kind of guy who speaks as much, or is it kind of every now and then if you speak it's everyone's turning around, like?
Yeah, no, I'd be quiet enough, I think. But I don't know, I suppose it could be similar enough. If you really feel compelled to say something, you'd say it. And I think a lot of players are like that. You have your few natural speakers that everyone just goes to listen to, but everyone as well has an opinion. And sometimes you do want to be, you do feel you need to give your opinion to the squad and think you're going to benefit. But I'm not a huge speaker now, but I could do the odd time.
Who was, because I was looking at one kind of, I think it was the Vodafone thing, was just introducing you, and Heaslip was saying how quiet you were when you first came in, yeah, as well. But was there any type of players that kind of stepped up and really helped you settle into the Irish squad when you first came in?
Yeah, the majority of players, to be honest, were quite helpful, yeah. it was really, really nervous first going up to the squad. But yeah, even all the real established players, everyone was helpful. Everyone was really kept you well relaxed and in the know. Just told you do your homework and should be and everything be fine. And yeah, it was as I said, it was they were really helpful though to keep everyone relaxed, I suppose.
And you, was it, have been, you know, you, not too long in the game, like around 3 or 4 years this stage, but some incredible games and some big moments you've been involved in. But are you a man for keeping hold of like memorabilia and jerseys and stuff like that? Would you hang on to much of it?
I have, I have a few jerseys, I suppose, that I traded after games, which I definitely will keep. It's not my, it's not at the forefront of my mind now. But I think you just do, you just get stuff like that as you go. Mm. But yeah, I'd have a few. I only just remembered that I had an Australian jersey from last season. That's about, it's the height of that.
In a kit bag somewhere.
No, I think back home in Kerry now. Yeah.
And well, that's even it. Would you have kind of like every year you get the new gear and the Irish gear and some of that? Are you a man for kind of giving that away to friends and family as well, or?
I think everyone does that really. Mm. Yeah, because it just piles up. Even it's great gear as well. But like I say, even we get loads of amazing of great gear. But sure, only less than a year away we're going to get the same amount. So you're going to naturally give some stuff away to those close to you that really want it.
And in terms of this game coming up the weekend, will your mum be up for a game like this? Does she go to many of your games? Yeah.
Oh, she'd be buzzing for a game like this now. Yeah, my brother as well, hopefully if he gets time off, and I'd say a few cousins as well who'd love to, everyone loves these kind of games. Mm. Yeah.
She's, what is it, even reading it past interviews, is like your mum's kind of a big person in your life, isn't she, and kind of inspired you so much?
Yeah, she'd drive me to all these trials from Tralee to Cork and Cork and Tralee to Limerick every, like, once or twice a week in summer, like, and even while working nights every second week, so she put a lot of work in.
Was there always kind of like a, as you kind of talked about, maybe having to make this trip up to the Connacht rather than playing with Munster or something like that, was there a time ever that you kind of felt rugby wasn't going to be the path for you? Like, did it ever come close to thinking that this might not be the journey you were going to go on?
Yeah, no, there's, I think every player, I don't know, does everyone get moments like that? I definitely did when I was, I think it was 17, 18. Mm. I think it was 18, just 18. And we just finished the under 19s season from Munster, and I'd just come back from an injury, didn't play too well. I was just back from a hand injury, and that just kept, I was kind of quite poor season with Munster 19s. I think I got dropped to the Munster Bees, who were actually going really well, and we won that, the Munster B Interpro as it was, but I still felt, because I got dropped from that Munster A 19s group, that I thought, oh, that's it now. And my mum said, it's not all. it's not everything, you know, you can always do, you can always play it for fun and all this. And I was thinking, yeah, sure, at least we do our best. I don't know how I got selected for the Irish 19s trials. It was this 3-day camp in Clongowes, and I was just so driven to do well in that, and luckily enough, I got selected for the squad, and we had a pretty successful season. I remember beating England 19 over there, which was great, and and that was it. And then after that, the whole academy contract came up for Connacht, and tough decision, but yeah, went with it.
And you were kind of talking about being driven to kind of do certain things. Do you have yourself some goals ahead for next, like, big couple of years for Irish rugby as well? Is there kind of positions are you kind of looking to kind of nail down a position this Irish team in the next few months?
You want to play consistently well for your province, and doing that will get you selected up there. You hope so. That's my first priority. You know, mm. I do have. Everyone, you have to have your goals, and I definitely do have some, so hopefully that'll help me achieve what I want in the future, you know.
And then within this Connacht squad, would you have kind of good guys you call friends, like guys you kind of...
I'd say everyone.
Yeah?
Yeah, not one person you don't get along with, not one person, it's great.
Even to kind of come in here is like, it's that kind of family kind of atmosphere as well in here, isn't it?
It really is, it's unreal, like, it's... It's you can't take it for granted, because you're essentially a teenager or whatever it is for 10 years. It really is a dream sometimes. Like, and even though you have your tough days, you just can't overlook all the good times you have. So.
And then for Irish fans, it might get a glimpse of next month a little bit more. Someone like Bundy Aki, what's he like to train with and kind of play with on a daily basis?
He's funny. He's a character, but he works really hard. He works really hard now. So hopefully, I'd say what he's thinking is just he wants to tick the right boxes in these games coming up, and whatever happens. I think I'm not too sure, but I presume that's it. That'd be his mindset.
For you guys, as you're saying, you kind of haven't played all the games against Munster yet, but often it's a good chance to kind of see where you are in the season, spark a little bit of a run as well, as you've done in the past, beating them here as well, and when you bet them down in Limerick there a couple of years ago as well. Is that again, having been in good form in the Challenge Cup, a good way to kick on and maybe get a result against Munster this weekend?
It is. Well, it's good for team morale and everything, but you still take your learnings from the game. It always feels great when you're winning, when you've just won the game, you're thinking, oh, thank God we've got the win. But then when you analyse everything that's going on, you have to find the flaws and the things that aren't going too right. And yeah, it's great for the confidence and stuff, but I mean, we still know that we still have a bit to go to play the way we're happy with, you know, a standard of which we're happy with sometimes, I think. But yeah, everyone's really excited for this weekend, so hopefully we can... You can do the job.
Good stuff. All right, listen, nice talking to you. All the best this weekend.
Cheers.
Good stuff there from Moulton Delan. Okay, we have fan questions and tips for the weekend's rugby on the way.
Murder, She Wrote is the perfect thing to watch during the day. You can watch the start, fall off for 40 minutes, come back, see the end, perfect. You know what I mean? You've missed nothing really. Remember Rod Kev in the Killiney, he used to have to bring two TVs into the room, one for you for Cheltenham. Like every red-blooded male in the country, he'd be watching the horse racing, whereas I'd have a TV for myself for things like Murder, She Wrote and Houses Under the Hammer. Murder, She Wrote is the perfect thing to watch during the day.
You're listening to the Hard Yards Rugby Podcast on Sports Joe. Thanks for listening. We're going to look ahead to the weekend's Pro 14 games now. Pat,
you're back in form.
I'm back in form. Yeah, it was a good Champions Week, Champions Cup week. We both called the Racing Munster spread. Just 10 points was too much. That came in 14-7, so we both did well there. And I did well with Leinster, and I did well with La Rochelle, unfortunately for Ulster. Also, those two other games, Treviso Toulon and Saracens Ospreys, finished very tight.
Yeah, that was, everybody was wrapped into that. You were great for providing Twitter updates of the Toulon Treviso game, and
I was massacring people's timelines with updates. But for Treviso to almost pull off that win against Toulon, Ian McKinley heavily involved in that one. Jesus, that would have been a win for the ages.
Ah, would have been absolutely. And it's as you've been championing them this season, but they've been backing you up, and you even kind of tipped them to kind of give Toulon a good game after the Bath game as well. So it's just great to see. And hopefully they can just keep, I know they didn't get the win, but hopefully they can just keep this up over the course of the season, because there seems to be a real change in mentality there, with the likes of Bradley coming in and Kieran Crowley, and then Conor O'Shea. Yeah,
on the Zebra side, yeah, and then just Treviso, they're proven handfuls in every game this season. It's really good to see. Right, so the Pro 14 is back. Start the Interpros. Connacht and Munster. Munster travel to Galway. They are 3-point favourites.
This always was over the last couple of seasons, the big thing for Munster to kind of, or like for Connacht to show that they were around and that they're a team to be reckoned with, but they're not the same team at the moment. And even though they're coming off a good couple of results in the Challenge Cup, I'll go for Munster on that one. It'd be interesting to see. I think Munster are going to go a pretty decent strength side, so I'm going to go Munster to beat them. Back them as well.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that one. I think it's going to be Munster. It's just a matter of how many. Sorry, Connacht fans, I know it's going to really annoy you, but that's the view of the two guys here. And then we go up to Kingspan, Ulster and Leinster. Leinster are, it's, what am I saying here? There is no favourite in terms of the spread, which means that Leinster are viewed as the better side. but they're away from home. So how do we see this?
So this is just we pick a winner? Is this all we have to do?
I think so.
I'll let you go first because I'm always hogging it.
This is true. So I'm going to go for an Ulster win. But I am really sweating on injuries.
I think I'll go with Leinster on that one. It's just because they just keep... Ever since, I think I was burnt by them when they went to South Africa and backed them and they let me down. So I've kind of held a grudge against them since. But I'm going to say they're going to get over the line. It should be a close game. But I'll go Leinster in that one.
Okay, so I really, really need an understrength Leinster side if you're out there. Right, we'll zip through the other games now. Glasgow, heavy 32-point favourites versus the Kings.
It's a big thing, isn't it? It's 32.
32 for a lot of points.
God. That would want to be some trash. I'm going to go for the Kings on that one. Okay. Not to win, but not to get beaten by 32 points.
Okay. I'm going to go with the 32 points in this. I'm going to go Glasgow, and that is a huge gamble. Ospreys, 12-point favourites at home to Dragons.
Interesting. I probably wouldn't have called Ospreys before that Saracens game, but they were...
That's thrown me.
Yeah.
Didn't see that one coming.
There's like a little bit of fire back in them, maybe. Even though they got pipped, but... it's minus 12, they're home. Ospreys, yeah, alright. There's no confidence in me saying that at all there.
No, there was no confidence, and I'm going the Dragon side. And, but that is not said with a huge amount of confidence. Yeah. Now, Treviso, Edinburgh, right? Alan, the producer, is heavy on Treviso on this one because they're a 3-point underdog. So Edinburgh are favourites here by 3.
And Edinburgh, didn't they have some captaincy issues as well this week? And
they've got a number of issues. So on the credit side, they went to Krasny Yar, who had beaten Stade Francais. Mm. Now, since then, Stade Francais got hockeyed at home by London Irish in the Challenge Cup. So I think we know where Stade's priorities lie this season. Edinburgh went to Moscow and put 70 points on them. So they're going to be feeling pretty good. On the debit side, they've lost their captain. They've got issues.
Yeah.
I can imagine Richard Cockerell taking that really well.
He'd be good. Remember we spoke... Yeah, it'd be great to get him on the phone for a chat at some stage, wouldn't it? But I'd say he's just come in and he is a way of working things. And he's just a force of personality, isn't he? And hopefully it works out for the best for him, but...
So Treviso or Edinburgh?
Treviso.
Yeah. I'm the same. I think Treviso are now... They're good and backable. No one's secret anymore. So we'll take those. Zebre are at home to the Cheetahs. Cheetahs are 3-point favourites. Sorry, correction, 4-point favourites.
Cheetahs favourites. This is going to be a tough one.
Yeah.
I'll go Zebre in this one.
Yeah, and I'm going to go with the Cheetahs, but I can see why you've gone for Zebre. We've talked about this previously. The two Italian sides doing well. They're rewarding us. I hope they don't this week.
Yeah.
And last game, Scarlets against Blues. Scarlets are 12-point favourites at home. Now, are Scarlets going to put all their eggs into the Pro 14 this season, just like Glasgow might do as well? Because they're down early.
Yeah. See what bodies are lining up to play this weekend, see who's fit to play. It was kind of unexpected last year, no one really retains the Pro 14, it'd be a massive achievement to do it. I'll let you go first on that one.
Okay, I'll go with Scarlets. I will go with them to cover that 12-point handicap.
I'll back you up. A nice kind of boring way to finish off there.
Okay. Right. And as of now, favourites to win the grand final. Leinster clear favourites 5-4.
Oh really?
Yeah. 5-4. Scarlets Glasgow 4-1. Munster 5-1. Cheetahs are 22-1. Forgot Ulster 9-1. Ospreys 66-1. Everyone else 200-1. So basically it's Leinster, then a clutch of teams, but the Cheetahs are up there. So it'll be interesting to see, can they come and do on their European spin this time around, can they take points back?
Pick a couple of results up, yeah. And Leinster's odds haven't been affected by Josh van der Fleer's injury at all there. I would have thought they would have shot out to massive underdogs after that.
I suppose there's few players who can affect a line that much. But sure, listen. We'll see how the weekend unfolds. Up next, we have listener questions for Kev.
The Hard Yards, passionate about sport.
Kev's back in to answer your fan questions. We put out a call on Twitter and these are some of the ones we got in. Use the hashtag AskTHY if you want to ask a question next week. First one from JP Diggins. When is a knockout not a HIA? Okay, the background for this. The background for this. This came in after the para incident in the Northampton and Claremont game. There's a few things here, but it's actually a deceptively simple question. So, Kev, answer that question in isolation before we go anywhere else. When is a knockout not a HIA?
A knockout is never a HIA.
Why?
My understanding, even from when I was playing, going back 10 years at this point, it feels like, is that if you're knocked out, you're off the pitch and you don't get tested. You're just told by the referee even that you're not allowed to come back.
That is correct.
But sometimes it's hard to know whether someone's knocked out or not, like, because you can be lying there rolling around with your head down and no one knows whether you actually went black or not. Sometimes it's really obvious. There's a few like high profile cases where it's clear a guy's actually unconscious. But like sometimes when you black out and from a concussion, you still move around, you wriggle around and stuff, even though you're not conscious. So it is a difficult one to call. And like the players will immediately... I do remember getting knocked out once and I came to... It was during training and one of the physios tried to like pull me off the pitch and I was like, what are you doing? Get your hands off me. There's nothing wrong with me. Like I fully thought I was fine.
Yep.
So that's what the physios and doctors are dealing with. And that's where the footage, I know for the high profile games now, they can go back and they can have a look at the footage.
Yep.
And they can actually see... I think you can tell by how the body responds if it looks a bit...
And that's the point, right? So you made a really interesting point there. So firstly, the player is not a reliable source of information in something like that. So you basically have to discount anything that the player says, okay? And that's fine. So you move that off the table. But then it is very, very hard for someone who's not medically trained or hasn't had the training that, for example, a high-profile referee would have to spot the signs, because going completely limp without movement can be a sign of lost consciousness. Equally... there's certain spasming that can also be a sign of lost consciousness.
But the point
is, none of us here are medically trained. But what happened in that match was not actually about the medical. The starting point was a referee saying he's unconscious.
Mm.
Once that happens, that player should be gone.
Mm.
And that's where I think we have confusion. And the statement from the EPCR, Pat, that came out was weird. Because first two things which just don't make sense. Firstly, the confusion that the referee introduced, they glossed over that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think they've missed a learning opportunity for rugby, for everyone, from fans to media to even the referee community. I've been talking to referees, some of them aren't aware of that. And the other thing was they somehow revealed that the HIA said, he didn't lose consciousness. That's not what a HIA does.
Yeah. How do you prove that then?
Yeah. So there's a number of things that are wrong there, and it would be fascinating to me to see if World Rugby step in, because they have done it in a couple of cases in the past. But it's a shame. I mean, Kev, for your particular situation, we're still here a number of years later, and we still have these moments where there is confusion, and there shouldn't be confusion around some aspects of this.
No, in this case, it sounds like there definitely shouldn't be confusion. And I think, like, the general guidelines, I know in the IRFU for certain reasons, if there's a suspicion of a knockout, the player comes off, and no HIA, even a suspicion. And I think there's some good examples of that on, even in the national team, high profile cases, a guy's been dragged off against their will. That's what it takes, really. It's a phenomenal conflict of interest.
It is, and those
the coach ultimately has direct connection to the doctor and the physio via their earpiece. Yeah.
And to be clear, this could be almost a subconscious conflict of interest as well. You know, the doctor has to deal with these players on a day-to-day basis as well. So I want to be very clear that when there's criticism around a player not being removed, that is not a direct criticism of the doctors involved. As long as they follow the process,
exactly,
that's fine.
I think the high-profile cases are so important, though. I keep going back to that because... I'll never forget November last year against New Zealand, key part of the game. One of the doctors from Leinster, and with Ireland now, Kieran, literally almost dragging CJ Stander off the pitch against his will. Mm. And like that is making a statement, not just the Irish rugby, the world rugby, that like the Irish team are doing the best to look after their players.
There are big moments when other people are looking in. People from lower levels seeing that happen, it's really important. We saw with Aina Falvey when he was involved in the team as well. He was not afraid to say, look, you're off. And to be seen on TV in front of hundreds of thousands, millions of people doing
that. Yeah, yeah. No, it is hard, but like it comes from the top. Like Joe was in Kieran Cosgrave's ear saying CJ needs to come off. And like that that's just a huge statement. And you're right, because all the kids, the aspiring players, are looking at CJ going, he's the toughest guy in Irish rugby.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
he is being hauled off the pitch.
Yeah.
Because he got a head knock and they're looking after him. And this is now a serious injury. It's okay. something that we need to take seriously.
So we've got, in summary, if there's a knockout, there is no HIA. You're just off. And also, message, which is an important one, is you do not need to have a knockout to come to be sent off that pitch permanently removed. Okay? So we'll end it there. It'll be a good one to have a talk to with a medic sometime to get a, you know, a more in-depth perspective, but I think we've exhausted our combined expertise here for now. Right. Okay, next question. From Talking Leinster. Who is your choice for best scrum half in Ireland behind Conor Murray?
Luke McGrath. I'd go Luke McGrath. There's a lot of talk about John Cooney, and he's had a great start to the season. It's great to see him get a run, but I think Luke McGrath's got that kind of, it's the mentality as well as the skill as well, and he's, the fact that he's, what is he, still only 24 maybe, like, and he's just started the season, no one talks about him, like, because he's just that accomplished as a player, like, and I like Marmion, I've dealt with him a few times, but I think Luke McGrath's that level above him.
Yeah, and I know Lukey personally, he's a great fella, he's great for
getting
culture.
Your bias out of the way there, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's from Talking Leinster, so I'm happy to give a very biased opinion. But Lukey, like, he's, you know, he's worked hard on his weaknesses over the past couple of years, I know, because from when I was in there, he was doing about 5,000 passes a day. I remember he was leveraging people like Owen Redden when he was still in the environment and learning from him. And, like, his game has just come on so much. And he's like Conor Murray in the physicality he brings as well, which is actually huge in the modern game. The amount of tackles scrum halves have to make now versus even a few years ago, having someone who can actually empty people like Luke can is huge. But yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see how Kieran Marmion goes this year. It's a big season for him. John Cooney in Ulster is
we've said that about Marmion for a few years now. It's a big season for him, and you know, he did have some good runs in the Ireland shirt.
Yeah. And I was in the Millennium earlier this year when he came on. He took a number 8 off over the sideline, maybe it was Ball or something, actually no, second row Ball over the sideline, and comes in, remember his big tackle on Pocock last year as well, like, and he just keeps having these moments where he steps up, but yet everybody, it's not only us, it'll be other people online and other reporters as well, they always ask a question about him, so maybe it's the fact that he's a little bit quiet or something like that kind of goes against him. But
is he not making as many breaks as he used to, or is it just the teams are more aware of his threat? Is it one of those kind of
like, he might just be a little bit more, you know, once you're in that Irish setup, as you've even seen with Stander, like, you're a little bit more
marked.
Yeah, there's more footage of you. Like,
oh, that's it. Okay, last one. When handed big fines, whose pocket does the money actually come from? Is there a contingency bucket for just this? This is from the Black and Red, and it's the name Ronan O'Gara is not mentioned anywhere in this, so I want to make sure that that's clear, right? But seriously, Gav, if there's a let's say there's a disciplinary matter, there's a fine comes from Central, from the league, from the tournament. Is that paid out of a player's own pocket, or is there a Central bucket?
Genuinely, I don't know the answer to that question.
Were you a very good boy, were you?
I was a very good boy. I was. I got 2 yellow cards in my career, both just from being sloppy, not from being violent. I wasn't a violent player. I never had the energy for it. I was always too tired. But I was also like, I can just smack him in a tackle or a ruck. I actually don't need to punch him. Like, that was always my opinion on it. Like, take my aggression out in a legal way. And that's the whole point of rugby. But no, like, I'd imagine that an external fine gets paid by the club, and then if you're fined internally, the player pays it. That would be my guess now, but I actually genuinely don't have a clue.
They might rope you in to do like a fundraiser or kind of show your face or something like that, for like, you know, like, you might have to go and do some corporate work or something like that to pay for the fine, maybe.
Well, is that the equivalent of community service?
Yeah. Going glad hand some people for a couple of hours.
Okay, I think we'll leave the questions there. Use the hashtag AskTHY on Twitter if you want to ask a question next week. We had a competition this week for 2 tickets to Ulster versus Leinster at the Kingspan Stadium. The winner is Niall Hassan. The Pro 14 final takes place on May 26th in the Aviva Stadium. Tickets are available on Ticketmaster. Okay, that's it for this week. Thanks to Kev, Vinnie Hammond, Alton Delan and Pat McCarry, Alan Lachman for producing, and Paul Donningham was on sound. We'll be back next Thursday with a new podcast. Subscribe to it on iTunes, Podcast Republic, SoundCloud, and every good podcast app to get it straight to your phone. This has been The Hard Yards. I'm Andy McGeady. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
The Hard Yards, passionate about sport.
It's gone to the short side. Oh, it's not gone to the short side. short side. It's gone to the try line. Antonin Murray.
I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field, not you.
Hi, Rob. Zeeb's here. Just want to discuss the captaincy next.
He's calling.
When Ringrose comes through. Oh. That is brilliant from Ringrose. Ringrose is going here. What a score.